what we normally talk about, which is the text. So thank you guys all for your contributions and your thoughts. I think the wisdom from folks who have lived the experience as opposed to and are specific to the black-white issues in America right now is really important as context for what the Hasidim are going to talk about. I'm going to be real upfront. You know, the interesting thing, I'm really, my bailiwick, my wheelhouse is kind of twofold, social justice and Hasidut. The problem with that is neither the two shall meet. The two are very different. The Hasidim typically are not social justice minded, with a few exceptions. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter of the Musar movement was very social justice minded. Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's kind of a modern Hasid almost, is very social justice minded. And Joseph Soloveitchik to a lesser degree, although you could argue whether he's Hasidic or social justice, he's a little bit of both, but also neither of either. To be fair, the Hasidim, as we've talked about many times in this class, are interested in the inward spiritual journey. And typically, as you all probably know, New Age inward philosophy that's long on meditation and spirituality typically says that we should transcend situations outside. We should transcend physical manifestation and corporeality. We should transcend things like color and race and violence, right? To some degree, it's a little bit Gandhi or Martin Luther King-esque to be a Hasid, which is if someone hits you with a nightstick, take it, because it's not real anyways. You know, just transcend the physical violence, transcend the pain, which is a somewhat useful and somewhat troubling message. But that being said, it's very also important to kind of note there are opportunities. If you look at the text, I think one of the things you could say is when texts don't spend a lot of time talking about social justice or social unrest, when they do allude to it, it's even more valuable, right? Anybody can pick up Dr. Martin Luther King or Abraham Joshua Heschel and find 100 messages of social justice and social unrest. To pick out the kernels of some of the great Hasidic Rebbeim, where they make an important moral or ethical stand or kind of discuss the general principles of social unrest, is even more valuable because it's so, they only mentioned it once in a while, and so it becomes even more valuable, right? Okay. We're going to take a look at the text now. Please direct your attention to the screen unless you printed this copy out for yourself. And of course, bear with me while I try and find it. Because as you all know, I'm not an expert in Zoom yet. Okay. Do you all see it on your screen? Thumbs up if you can see it. Okay. And I will make it larger because I know you're going to say that next. Okay, so today's the 11th of Sivan, 5780. We're going to start with my favorite. So this was one of the things that's interesting is that I went all over. The text is coming from everywhere in our tradition. The main place I looked in a couple of parshas where I know the text is social justice relevant. I also looked at the Psalms and in the prophets. And the reason is there are specific psalms, and then generally the prophets are very interested in social justice. So I knew that the Hasidim, when they commented on those verses, would be forced. They'd be backed into a corner, and they'd have to address questions of unrest and justice and equality. So our first text is one that I actually gave a Dvar Torah on months ago. It's really the best one. If you forget everything else I say, this one is the one to take home. So in Genesis 18:26 is the story of Abraham and Sodom and Gomorrah. When Abraham stands up to God and asks the question, are you really going to destroy this city? And then bargains him down to, if you find 10 righteous individuals, you should not destroy this city. And God agrees, but ultimately does not find 10 righteous individuals in Sodom and Gomorrah. But the bargaining is very, really interesting. And the verbiage that's used in the text is, as always, very interesting. So here's what the text says. Vayomer Adonai el im emtsa bistom chamishim tzadikim betoch ha'ir V'naseti l'chol hamakom ba'avuram. And God said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous amongst the city, then I will forgive all the place for their sake. So I put my finger up for the word betoch, because betoch ha'ir is going to be an interesting phrase. Betoch means in the midst or amidst. All right. So one of our favorites, Rabbi Simcha Bunim of Pshischa, who was a second generation to the Baal Shem Tov. He would have learned with the Magid of Mezrich, who was the immediate disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. And Simcha Bunim said this: it is not enough for the righteous to park themselves on the benches of the Beit Midrash, the house of study. Instead, the righteous find themselves betoch ha'ir, in the middle of the city, mixed in with the people, inextricably involved in the actions of the world. This is what a tzaddik, a righteous person, is. As such, God will raise up and forgive the whole of the city on behalf of their actions. So this is an amazing text, right? In the Hasidic and pre-Hasidic world, the general belief is, if you are studying Torah all day long in the Beit Midrash, you are a righteous and holy individual. And Simcha Bunim says, that's bogus. I don't buy any of that, right? And he pins it on this verse right here, that the tzaddikim that God mentions are mentioned as if they are betoch ha'ir, amidst the city. And Simcha Bunim says that righteousness is predicated on finding yourself not apart from the city that you are in, but amidst it, that you are part of it, that you are inextricably linked to your neighbors and to your brother, right? For a religious individual to look out their window at a riot where black people are being tear gassed because they want nothing more than the right to not be beaten by cops or suffocated when they're arrested, but to be treated the same way as a white person would be when they are arrested, it is not righteousness, right? You can't be a righteous person, study holy text, and then live as if you are apart from your city. You are a part from of your city, right? You are betoch ha'ir, you are amidst it. So when you look out on Penn Avenue and say to yourself, something's going on out there, the righteous person goes out into the city. The righteous person decides to be involved in what's going on. They care about voting. They care about policing. They care about their school system. They care about the environment, right? And that is a necessity of being righteous. I think one of the other things that's important is there's a yin-yang or a difference of opinion within Judaism about whether when we talk about the righteous, we're saying only the elites and only a small segmented group, right? One of those texts in Judaism that I never like is this concept of the 36 righteous in every generation, that there are only truly 36 righteous individuals. And sometimes I like that text because we're all aspiring to be one of those 36. But another way to look at it is that we all should be seeing ourselves as if we are righteous. So righteousness is not learning Torah all day long. Righteousness is getting off the benches and being part of your city. Okay. Next text. So that one is a good one. I put it up front, not only because chronologically it shows up first, but also because it's a banger. You're not going to get a better one than that. So disclaimer, I started hot. I started good. And you may find things get less interesting from here. All right. Next text is one that was a struggle for me. And the struggle was, there are a couple of these where it's a favorite line from the Torah. I looked at what the Hasidim say, and generally I was disappointed. Generally, I found that they did not satisfy, or they skipped this verse altogether. So it's a famous story, Exodus 2, right? Moses grows up in Pharaoh's house. He hits adolescence or his adulthood, and he goes out of the palace to see what's going on. And what does he see? Either the first time he goes out of the palace or the first time he really truly opens his eyes when he goes out of the palace, he sees a man being beaten, right? He sees a Hebrew slave being whipped by a taskmaster. And that you know, violence against an innocent individual who is of a different racial background than his oppressor was a pretty obvious one for me to pick as a text to take a look at. So here's the literal of that text. Sometime after that, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his kinsfolk and witnessed their oppression. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. Now, the Hebrew word for witness their oppression is vayar basivlotam. The original translation from JPS is actually not their oppression, but was originally their labor, which I found odd, right? Usually, the Hebrew word for work is oved or avodah or avedut, would be either servitude or slavery. Sivlotam is suffering or oppression. Why JPS decided that vayar basivlotam should be their labor, I don't know. I disagree strongly with the translation, and you notice that I changed it, right? It's oppression. So anyways, Rabbi Aharon Rokeach of Belz, who would have been, I think he's either the third or the fifth Belzer Rebbe, I forget. And I'll tell you a little bit of his story afterwards. He said this: Moses did not search the sins of Israel. Even though they were worshipers of false idols, he didn't see that at all. Rather, he saw their oppression. He saw the pain of Israel. So there's two things going on in this text that I thought made it noteworthy. Thing one is it's a really frequent concept in Hasidut to, I wouldn't say exactly victim blame, but close, right? To basically say, like, okay, we are suffering, and the reason we're suffering is because we have displeased our God. We are morally faulty, and we should search our deeds and find what we are doing wrong in order to change our ways, right? Suffering as a path to bettering ourselves, right? That's a very classic Hasidic take. And here, the Belzer Rebbe understands that Moses does not do this, right? He doesn't say, oh, the people Israel are in servitude because we're trying to learn a lesson here. Moreover, to say, the Jewish people under slavery to Pharaoh are not faithful to God. They're worshiping false idols. They're not keeping commandments. They've completely forgotten the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which our text kind of references over and over again, and the commentators of the medieval period reference over and over again. He ignores it. He doesn't say, like, oh, we should check our deeds and see what's causing our oppression. He ignores all that, the Avodah Zarah, the idol worship, and he says that it's their pain that they are... that their oppression is what's going on, that should be what they are noted for. Someone's getting a phone call. If you could mute yourself, that'd be great. He saw their oppression. He saw the pain of Israel. He ignores that they may have been faithless and they may have committed sins and focuses in only on the suffering that the individual has. So why do I bring this one up as a text? Because it's about this thing that's often called both sidesism, right? One could say, look at the looting, look at the violence, look at the burning, look at the vandalism, right? And say, it undoes all of the claims of the protesters for injustice. And I think the Belzer Rebbe kind of points out that, like, yeah, you know, the Israelites were crappy too. They weren't necessarily completely justified in being redeemed from bondage. They weren't faithful to God in this time. But Moses doesn't see that. Moses sees their oppression and focuses on their oppression. So when you're having a narrative with another person and they're saying, what about the protesters? What about the, it's called whataboutism in the colloquial speak of our time, right? You just turn it back and you're like, can you deny that a white cop put his knee on a black person and suffocated him to death for 9 minutes while three other cops watched and did nothing, and while the videotape rolled and rolled and rolled, and the bystanders yelled, "You're killing him," and the individual said, "I can't breathe," right? Can you deny that? And the answer is no, nobody can deny that. So no matter how much you might get frustrated, or any individual you talk to might get frustrated at broken windows and looting and vandalism, which are all inappropriate and terrible and not a proper way to change the situation in America, you just skip past it. Because if the Belzer Rebbe could do it, then you could do it. And if Moshe Rabbeinu can do it, then you can do it. Point at the oppression. Don't point at the method of protest. I thought that was a remarkable text. I'll add one more thing. You should look up more about this guy if you want to, or just skip to Wikipedia right now. Rabbi Aaron Rokeach of Belz was, you see his dates, 1880 to 1957. He has the most remarkable story of survival from the Nazis. He had to, at some point, shave his beard and his payas and pose as a Russian general who was being secretly moved across Nazi lines from Poland to Romania in order to survive. Him and his brother, I think either his brother or his son, survived. Both of their wives and all of their children were killed by the Nazis. So I often mention this, that when a Hasidic Rav who lived through World War II and the Holocaust talks about systematic oppression, it's not from nothing. It's from personal experience. And I think that's always valuable, right? It's easy for me, Rabbi Goodman, living in my middle class home in Squirrel Hill, to talk about oppression. It's different when the Belzer Rebbe talks about it, having, you know, he had to be scurried out of his own community, not one, but two different ghettos. He was in the Grolsch ghetto and the Warsaw ghetto, I think. So that kind of suffering and survival is a remarkable thing. All right, keep moving. I know this week there's a very good chance that I'm not going to be able to finish all the texts, but I think it's still valuable to attempt to finish all the texts. Okay, I'll get as far as I can, and then we'll stop. We'll do one more text, and I'll open it up for people to kind of comment if you have any thoughts. So right now we're on to Isaiah 12. So we're into the prophets, right? So the prophets were people who were integrally concerned with the suffering of the Israelites by the hands of foreign nations as an expression of injustice that was going on in their own countries. For more on this, you can read any one of myriad books. I recommend The Prophets by Abraham Joshua Heschel. But the prophets were generally interested in injustice and believed that the suffering of Israel was due to the injustice that they themselves were committing. So here's a really famous line that you may know from somewhere else in the Jewish tradition. Here's the line from Isaiah 12:2. Hine el Yeshuati eftach velo echad ki ozi v'zimrat ya Adonai v'ahi li lishua. We say this to start off Havdalah every week, okay? That's where it comes from, but it's originally from Isaiah. So if you don't know, now you know. Behold the God who gives me triumph. I am secure and I will not fear. For Yah, the Lord, is my strength and my might, and God has become my deliverance. Now the interesting thing about this line that our commentator is going to bring up, I think, is that this line shows up somewhere else. Kiyozi v'zimra ya Adonai v'ihili lishua. We also say every morning in prayer. It's part of Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea, when Moses splits the Red Sea. So this is Isaiah making a reference to a thing that we say in Exodus. But there's a slight difference. So we'll actually see that in a minute. But the first up is this very short line where he says, where we have a comment by a guy by the name of the Arve Nachal, Rabbi David Shlomo Eibenschutz, who was in Soroka and then emigrated to Palestine in the early 1800s. And he said, the goal of security is easy enough to achieve, more so than a level of fear, that this is much higher. And I know some of you don't like the concept of yirah, of divine fear, but I think it's really interesting to point out that, like, eftach velo efchad, I am secure and I will not fear, is an understanding of reaching one level of connection with the divine, of recognizing when you get to know God, that you become secure. But a higher understanding of the divine is a lack of security, is knowing that there is anxiety and difficulty and fear kind of integrally encoded into the universe, right? And I know a lot of you don't love the concept of Yirat Shemayim, the fear of heaven, but I would say that fear and uncertainty are kind of a thing that in this, at least the Arve Nachal understands it, is a higher spiritual understanding. That at some point, to recognize that the universe is unsure, that chaos is kind of hardwired into the system, that things are always a little bit unstable, is a higher ordered understanding of the universe, right? I'll say it a different way, which is to wander around with a false sense of security, that everything is la-di-da, totally okay, and everything is totally fine all the time, is to be lulled into a false sense of security. And you can overdo this concept, for sure. But I think an understanding, it goes back to the thing I said at the beginning of the fight that I have with my wife, that like to say that America is great and we're doing really great and everything's going along, and then to wake up and suddenly be surprised that black people don't have equal rights and things are not going very well, it was possibly on some level us lulling ourselves into a false sense of security. But the Arve Nachal is saying, like, you know, accept a little efchad, accept a little fear into your soul. Accept that things are difficult and chaotic sometimes. Don't worry, we'll develop this idea more. I want to get people's reactions up till here. Not everybody may have liked all those texts, or maybe you have one of those three texts that you really, really liked, and you kind of want to comment on. So any thoughts up till here if you have a thing to say? Go ahead, Marilyn. Remember to unmute.
Yeah, yes, I fixed it. Just one brief thing, and that to go back to the very first one, that passage has always been among my favorites, going back to Abraham's question, not to God's response, because when you pose the direct question to God, should not the Lord of all do right? You're basically asking what is predominant in our faith. Is doing right one of the most important criteria for us as Jews? And for me, that has always been one of the reasons why I'm comfortable with my faith, is that I know that when push comes to shove, we're supposed to ask ourselves what is right, and we're supposed to act on what is right. And so I've always been very fond of the question, although a little upset that Abraham had to ask, and also comfortable with the answer that there is a way to look at this and say, even when there's evil in the world, how do you do right? You know, you choose and favor the right, you work to support the right. But if you can't find any goodness, well, then that's when he starts to lose me a little bit. But I've always loved this particular passage precisely because it makes ethics predominant.
Beautiful. I want to add one other piece to that, which is really cool off of this verse that I didn't mention before, which is I spent a lot of time talking about betoch, like being in the midst, and didn't spend any time talking about the choice the Torah makes here to use the word ha'ir, in the city, right? Jews have become, over the last 500 years, an urban people. We do not live in rural areas for a variety of important historical developmental reasons. We live in cities. We are a very citified people. We are super urban. And what that means is we are inextricably linked to the cities we live in. So I want to use that as an opportunity to recommend a book, which I like very much. It's one of my professors. It's called Justice in the City. It's a fairly straightforward book by a professor who is a fairly academic, highfalutin, fancy guy. And he's reading Talmudic texts for what they tell us about urban living and justice in urban settings. And so Jews are overwhelmingly now an urban people, and this issue that Marilyn brings up about justice comes up around justice in urban areas and the importance of urban justice specifically, that Jews are parts of cities, and cities are places where we're cheek and jowl by each other, and so it's very frequently that we see a lot of injustice. Go ahead, Marilyn.
I'm sorry, Pat. I was just going to ask you if you could put the title of the book and the author in the comments.
I will do so.
I can't read it. It's all blurred.
Oh, you got it. You got it. I will write it right now before I forget. The book is called, so Dr. Arya.
The title, all the other stuff is so small, it's blurring for me.
No problem.
I'm sorry.
I like it very much.
It's
by the way, it's a Talmudic book. So he's going to take a reading from the Talmud and then spin it out. So if that's not your bag, but it's still very, very nice. I put it in the comments. But I'm all in the bag for Arya because he was my Mishnah teacher in rabbinical school. Also, he kind of was one of my mentors in terms of like getting arrested, which is Arya's got a rap sheet that's a mile long, literally. He is the rabbi for Bend the Ark, which is a social justice organization here in the United States. He's been arrested for everything. So all of it justified, nothing. He also walks the walk in the sense that he grew up in Israel and was a tank commander in the 1980 war with Lebanon. So he kind of witnessed what it is to occupy another country in an unjust manner. And that kind of informed his whole worldview on Torah and Judaism, and grew up Orthodox. Go ahead, Joe.
Mark, we mostly know that you have a point to make, and you made it very well. I think most, if not all of us, agree with your point and think it was timely. Nevertheless, I sense a yin and yang here in Torah. Sabina mentioned, and I'm going to support my wife here a little bit, Sabina mentioned in public, I might ask. Sabina mentioned the Amalek passage. I sense that this dichotomy as to how to deal with these situations has been going on for thousands of years. So even though you and I would like to make this into a simple thing, something about human physiology, biology, makes it difficult for us to deal with these things in a just and simple kind of way. Your comments about how the Amalek passage has been reinterpreted by many rabbis, notwithstanding that, I think we've got to admit that it's just not cut and dry, and the Civil War may not be over.
Yeah, I think to say, yes, life is messy would be a good summary of that. And I think one of the things I see, because I spend a lot of time in public on Twitter talking to people, teaching classes with diverse groups who have different political opinions. Yeah, you're late on Morris Segal.
Well, she's not here.
Well, then it's probably too late for Morris Segal. That's okay. Do some Hebrew later, okay? Sorry, short interruption for something of resembling parenting. Life is messy, was what I was saying, and I think it's really easy to say that, policing should be better. And black people should always be treated equally in policing, while hypothetically simultaneously forgetting that there are bad people and there are people who, when the police have to arrest them, create a great threat to the police, right? And the job of a police officer is inherently difficult and is inherently scary. And I think that that's really important. And by the way, I've been screamed at Twitter for saying nice things about police officers, right? I've been screamed at for complimenting individuals for arresting me appropriately, right? And there's both. The challenge with the Amalek text is that the Amalek text is written about an ethnic group, basically. It's straight up, this people are all evil. They are an ethnic group of evil. And that just doesn't exist anymore, right? There's no such thing as a people who are wholly evil, that are ethnically, genetically composed bad, right? It's just not a fundamental. To read it that way requires unreading Genesis 1, which says that God created human beings in the image of the divine, right? When God creates a human being, even if they turn out to be a scumbag and a criminal and a terrible human being down the road, they're all created with the potential of being just as good and just as moral and just as right as God, God's self. So it's life is messy. Go ahead, Joe.
I want to point out that it's not a coincidence that the demonstrations are happening now, and they're not quieting down as quick as they did in the past. We are indeed in a difficult period of history in the making. It's as a minimum, it's as difficult as the period of that maybe stretched from the mid-60s into the mid-70s. We have an administration, let's start a little, since 1980, the disparity in wealth has been growing. We have an administration in office now that is polarizing the country like we haven't seen, maybe worse than the Nixon time period. We have an immediate cause, the policeman's knee on this guy Floyd. When the black community has suffered more than any other distinct community in America. And to get back to the tzaddik concept, we absolutely, as a very minimum, as a beginning, we need to make ourselves felt on November 4th.
Thank you. I'm going to close because I have to get the last word, because that's what rabbis do, with a thing that, Joe, you inspired me to say, which is, as I was just thinking about it, is back to what my daughter this morning. She came and, you know, she's 7, so reading her a New York Times article is probably not going to work. But the New York Times had a series of pictures about the demonstrations. And as we were skimming through the pictures, one was of a little black girl. And my daughter looked at her and said, "Who's that?" And I looked at the caption, and the caption was that it was George Floyd's daughter. And Floyd was 52 years old, and his daughter is 6, and my daughter is 7. And she had this kind of look at her face, and my daughter looked at her and looked at me and said, "I think she's looking down and she's sad because her daddy's not alive and won't be there anymore." It broke my heart, you know, or broke my heart. The guy got arrested for passing what he may or may not have known to be a fake $20 bill, and it ended his life. And he doesn't come home to his daughter ever again, and she grows up without a father. And that's, I think, a thing to kind of hold, even as hard as it is to walk away, that there's the big tragedy of America and the lack of leadership, and then there are the small tragedies that we all have to kind of face and live with. I left a lot of texts unstudied. I think we'll hopefully, if we get a chance, we'll take a look at them next week. You guys are welcome to hang around and raise the mood again if you'd like. But I appreciate everybody's comments and contributions today and your willingness to be here for what is, of course, like a difficult time, but I hope that some of it can be useful and cathartic and help you to process and be part of a group that cares about our neighbors and cares about our community. So thanks, everybody.